This is a production of Cornell University.
Hi, everyone. Okay, it is now 4:47. We're about to get our meeting started. So can everyone take your table, your seats? Okay, I'm gonna start with our land acknowledgement. Cornell University is located on the traditional homelands of the Gayogano Cayuga Nation. The Gayogano are members of the Haudenosaunee Confederacy, an alliance of six sovereign nations with a historic and contemporary presence on this land. The Confederacy precedes the establishment of Cornell University, New York State, and the United States of America. We acknowledge the painful history of the Gayogano dispossession and honor the ongoing connection of Gayogano people, past and present, to these lands and waters. Okay, so everyone, I know that we are gonna have people joining us on Zoom today. We also have a larger gallery than usual, so I just wanna remind you all to be using microphones as you're speaking today. Can I please get a count on the members we have present?
Adele Williams. Amari Lampert. Annette Gleiberman.
Here.
Annalie Onoye.
Here.
Claire Templeman. Claudia Leone. Deepak Ilongo. Dylan Eisman. Duncan Katie.
Here.
Esther Bentalila. Everest Yan. Henry Wade. Genevieve Bansaw.
She's running late.
John John Jiang. Joseph Mullen. Kate Santa Cruz. Krenal Thacker. Lucas Smith. Manaya Lewis. Morgan Baker. Nicole Overton,
here.
Nikki Reddy,
here.
Payne Gronmeyer,
here.
Valeria Valencia, Yananawi Logan. I have 17 members present. That doesn't count Genevieve.
Okay, when she comes. Perfect. Thank you so much. The time is now 4:50. We have 17 members present. I'm officially calling this meeting to order. Okay, so first we're going to start with any late additions to the agenda. Representative Katie.
I know we've spoken about this previously, but I would just like to go over the committee nomination at the end of our meeting, if possible.
Okay, do we have a second to that?
Is this on? Oh, there we go. I was wondering if we can go over the committee nominations. I was speaking with a community member who would like to be nominated, so to one of the UA committees.
Okay, perfect. Any other late additions? Okay, now I'm going to move into approval of our meeting minutes from September 23rd. Representative Templeman.
Motion to approve by unanimous consent.
Second. Okay, any dissent to that? Perfect. Those meeting minutes are approved. Now we'll move into open microphone. This is for any community members who have anything they'd like to say. Okay, and then now we are gonna move into announcements and reports, and we have the Vice President of Enrollment, John Burdick, here to speak with us today.
Good afternoon, everyone. Thank you for the opportunity to come and learn about SA and to meet with you and to hear about your ideas and questions related to financial aid. In an ideal world, I would have been here much sooner and much more often. That's been my joy about being in higher education now for 37 years is working with students and from a student perspective. So I hope to capture that at Cornell. I was a bit disrupted by COVID. I came here in August of 2019 into this new role as vice provost for enrollment, which means admissions, financial aid, and registrar are all my reporting areas, sort of the core of student services. I'm not a financial aid professional by main foundation training. I've spent some time as a financial aid professional and some time directing financial aid offices at my previous employer, the University of Southern California and the University of Rochester. Oh, sorry, I'll speak closer. Yeah, sorry. So I'm coming from a perspective of wanting to be helpful and wanting to learn from you, and I'll explain why. But basically, if there are detailed questions about things that are going on in the financial aid realm, especially detailed questions that are informed by your personal experience, I can't claim for sure that I'm ready to answer all of them. I'm not an expert on every dimension of Pell Grants or anything like that, but I will take copious notes. And if there's a right opportunity to come back with the new director of financial aid, who is here in his 11th week on the job, and others from my area that would be helpful to explain anything in more detail, we would commit to doing that as soon as it's convenient and needed for you. But I wanted to give you the big picture of what's going on and where our progress is. When I arrived in August 2019 at Cornell, Cornell was already in what I'd characterize as largely a financial aid crisis, not in the sense of spending or ability to fund students, but we had had some years of not understanding fully and certainly not implementing fully our responsibilities with compliance with the federal government, with the Veterans Organization, and with the Department of Education at New York State and federal government in the arena of compliance and regulation. So a massive effort was already underway as I arrived to make sure that we sort of cleaned up our act on those kinds of questions. That is ongoing. That has also been hugely disrupted by the COVID response that takes some of the same kinds of personnel away. But all of us, most of you included and myself, inherited a little bit of a sort of a full tilt, challenging environment for managing financial aid starting in August 2019 that has not really let up since. And it's in that framework that I would say sort of how I think about this meeting. We're not succeeding in financial aid. We haven't been succeeding in financial aid for a while in numerous dimensions. And the idea that I would have is that I would like, with any help that any of you can provide and other students you would identify, to get better with all of it. I think our intentions are clear. I think the financial aid staff is full of motivated, hardworking people. They've been working mostly 60-hour weeks since pandemic began, and in some cases before. They're smart, they're experienced in financial aid. They do have customer student needs at the heart of what they do. None of that is showing up in how this semester is going, or indeed how we've seen things for a year. So we're eager to keep going. So that's how I approach this meeting, is that this is an opportunity for me to get things going in a better way. Two things I would roll off the table. I have nothing to do with the student activity fee. Don't know how it's assigned or configured. I'd have to defer to others as experts on that kind of a question, and indeed any of the other kinds of fees that get charged. And although I have been very involved with tuition determinations and settings for my entire career, the actual decisions about tuition are well above my pay grade. I report to the provost, the provost reports to the president, and they both report to the board of trustees. Tuition is set by them. So I have full respect, tremendous respect for everybody that is in the sort of the fees must fall category or has serious questions about the money that Cornell collects and how we spend it. I would do my best to try to answer from my understanding what that is. It's just that's not my area. I'm about giving money to students to be able to meet the tuition, not about what the tuition is charged in the first place. Little bit of detail about where we are now, and then I just want to turn to any questions you might have. In the current semester of activity, we have, as many of you know, a lot of new students, and of course, a lot of grad students. Every part of our enrollment is up, not least the continuing undergraduate students. That's where we currently sit at not having reached the satisfactory level of service delivery. We are not in terrible shape in a percentage terms for almost the first day of October. There are 9,000 continuing students who receive aid services. 93% of those have their financial aid package and are progressing normally at this point. Some of those were certainly finished after the start of the semester, which is an incredible source of anxiety. I know that from my own personal experience with financial aid, going all the way back to when I was in college. Those 7% that are still going forward, that represents about 630 students who are still in progress in some way. Half of those are in the hands of individual counselors for review. The other half have had conversations with counselors saying we're missing an item, or as many of you know, the financial aid process can be complex. There's a piece of data in a tax return that's not matching up with a piece of data in a FAFSA or a profile. For those of you that file for financial aid, you're familiar with all of these documents. And we have to resolve that before we can progress to actually awarding a final package. Even of those 600 students, the vast majority have received an estimate. That estimate does not give them access to the funds directly, but it does sit as a credit on their bursar bills, which means they're not facing any kind of consequences, late fees, or in danger of not being able to engage in any Cornell activities. For on-campus students, on-campus living, that means their room and board, as well as their tuition, is covered by what's anticipated as their financial aid. They're not facing any consequences. For off-campus students, we've made them a priority since school began. They do face the consequences if they normally get a reimbursement beyond the tuition paid that goes to the university. They would use that money in some cases for rent and for food. I want to make sure that this group understands, and I had explained this to the Cornell Sun at one point as well, if anybody's facing a consequence where they don't have the money they need to pay those basic bills on a monthly basis, they absolutely should be coming to the financial aid office, camping in the financial aid office, doing whatever it takes to make sure that they get the funds and the support they need, and that will be made available to them. I had a long conversation today with the director of financial aid and clarified that if a student comes up declaring that it's emergency, the rent bill is coming tomorrow, or they have a grocery bill they gotta pay to pay for their food, they automatically go to the top of the queue for both completing their financial aid, making sure they get what they need, and if necessary, an emergency fund, a stopgap kind of check that will allow them to do that. So I don't want this to be, even though we have these delays, we don't want it to be disruptive in a core sense to anybody's education. I'm not talking about eliminating anxiety. We've obviously already produced that. In terms of the response, most of the good response to all this is what we would want to do moving forward. My response, which goes back about a year now to when I first realized this problem was emerging, was to enact a change in leadership in the financial aid office. That's why we have a new director, and also to fill what was a huge and rising personnel gap. So financial aid has about 33 funded positions, not all of them counselors, obviously. They do work behind the scenes. At our peak in the course of the last year, we were down 16 positions. And all of you are Cornell students, you probably realize that means we were about half of the strength that we need to run the financial aid office well. That has all kinds of consequences. It means the people who are left behind doing the work are working harder than ever, even though they don't have the productivity to show for it. It's debilitating, it's worrisome. And so the effort that I made starting in November of last year on a personal basis was to fill those gaps. Hiring a new director is part of that. I'm very pleased to say we created a new position who is a deputy director specifically for undergraduate student services. He starts tomorrow. He's an expert in financial aid coming to us from the University of Illinois. And he will actually be at the forefront of coming to you and to other student groups with some specific goals in mind. We've also generally had success. We've hired and filled 12 of those empty 16 positions, and we have two more in progress. So we will be in a financial aid office that is at full strength moving forward, and that gives me a lot of hope and expectation that the kind of issues we're seeing this semester won't be repeated at any point in the future. In terms of future directions and the roles for the students in the SA, you are, if you will, or you and the people you represent, my subject matter experts. Two key areas of financial aid improvement are student services and services in general, so you and in many cases your parents, and communications. I don't think that we've got all the right solutions for how to reach students to make sure they understand what's missing from their financial aid application processes. We don't reach out in all the platforms that are useful. We don't respond clearly in all the platforms that are useful. It's important that we have email. It's important that we have in-person services. It's important we have the phones. But if we're not able to handle the volume of needs on that basis, and if they're not the best ways to reach students and parents, we need to come up with better channels. So I'm eager to embrace all of you as our subject matter experts on services and communications in particular. Also very happy to hear all of your other questions or ideas or thoughts about how Cornell Financial Aid can and should be better, and to make your lives easier. And that's all I wanted to say, and I'm happy to take questions.
Thank you so much, VP Verdick. So everyone, I just want to, now we're gonna open up to questions and comments. So I just wanna talk about procedure for that. We're gonna put a 45-minute cap on this discussion. 1 minute for questions, and that's gonna be a hard stop with signals and cues from our parliamentarian Carson. And then a 1:30 response from VP Verdick. And the order that I'm gonna go is an SA representative, the gallery, and then Zoom. The chat is gonna be monitored by Noah, and he can give you direct comment from the chat that we get, anything we get from Zoom. And yeah, that's procedure. Just make sure that you're called on before you answer. And then we're also gonna have VP Vanta in the gallery, so she'll help direct anyone who wants to speak from the gallery.
Hello. So for the time signals, I'll make it uniform for all the speeches, whether they're a minute or a minute 30. I'll give this signal at 30 seconds, 30 seconds left, this signal at 15 seconds left, and then 10 on down, just so you know. And if you would like signals given another way, you can let me know, and I will.
Perfect. Thank you so much, everyone. So I'm going to get started with essay questions. Representative Templeman.
Thank you for taking the time to come and speak to us on this very important issue. And I guess, first of all, I guess the big question, the one I received most from my constituents, which is when will all students receive their financial aid?
So the intent has been to get there by October 1st, or at least that was the established intent back when the protest was happening in front of the Day Hall. Not met that yet. So at this point, I'm trying to make sure we mitigate the consequences for that for students. So I talked about the coming in for emergency aid or any kind of grant that they need to sort of keep going. I don't want to overpredict, but the volume that we're accomplishing now is hundreds per week, and we only have 600 initial reviews to go. There's also some outstanding loan processing and some outside agency scholarship checks coming through. I want to say that there's no reason for me to think we're not all cleared out on that before 2 to 3 weeks. That's would be my new projected conclusion. The hard stop for me that I've articulated a lot to the financial aid office and registrar is we don't want anybody in any kind of uncertainty when we get to pre-reg, which is normally in the early part of November.
Thank you.
Thank you. Now I will take a question from the gallery. Okay, I will take a question from, no question from Zoom. Okay, SA members. Representative Williams.
Hi, so I'd just like to thank you again for being here today. So I know you said that 93% of the students who requested aid have received it, except for about 630. However, some people who have gotten their aid have requested revisions because it is not accurate. I personally received a revision that accounted for an outside scholarship I got before getting my actual revision. And I received an email from your office saying it could take up to 3 months to receive that. Why is there no tuition freeze? Why am I still forced to pay an incorrect amount with no freeze? Yeah.
So a tuition freeze is not an idea I heard before. That would certainly not be my call, because the chief financial officer makes a determination about money flow like that. The tuition setting was back in March. That was obviously before any of this happened. I don't have a good answer to the why the no tuition freeze, because I don't entirely know how that would work.
Is there any any idea how long it's going to take for students to be getting those revisions requested then?
Yeah, sure. My understanding is we've had about 600 appeals. We're certainly expecting still more to come through. The main source of appeals is, unfortunately, a delay of COVID. There's some of you may know this. We base the financial aid you have this year on your 2019 family income. There's never been a more dramatic change in family income for some students than what happened in 2019 versus what happened in 2020 as the pandemic hit and people lost jobs. So we're getting this very high volume of appeals. It is definitely important. The way Cornell Financial Aid works, I'm not expecting that most students in appeals are getting a big difference, only because we're so careful and precise up front in evaluating all the documents and making sure that they all line up. So it is not typical for an appeal for Cornell Financial Aid to result in a difference of thousands of dollars. It's more often in the small hundreds of dollars. So that's why the estimates are there. The estimates are in place because we think the final analysis of aid is going to be a close match for the estimate. And appeals were put farther down the list because they don't usually change very much.
Thank you. So now I will go to the gallery for any questions. Okay, perfect. An SA member, Representative Mullen.
So I have here a list of testimonies from students who have submitted their own perspectives. I'm gonna give it to you after the meeting, so because I think this would be really insightful. But one that really stood out to me that I think is worth kind of asking you about is a student who reported that the bursar hold on their account is preventing them from being hired as a student worker on campus, and they're experiencing lost wages. So it seems like a compounding problem of the stress of not getting their financial aid, the stress of then not being able to work on campus and get the wages that they need to afford being a student here. And what I think is a real problem is the, and you pointed out, I'm glad you're cognizant of it, but the exacerbating stress of students who can't get their aid, then they can't work and they have nowhere to go, they don't know what to do. So I'm wondering if you can answer, is there any way we can address the bursar holds preventing students from being hired, from being able to work on campus? That seems like something we can make a change on because that seems ludicrous. Yeah.
I 100% agree with you. I just found out about that policy last week and I asked the people who are experts in my area, it's like, why do we do this? And nobody had a good answer. So it's sort of lost in the mists of time as to why this Cornell policy. There may be a perfectly valid reason why it's true, but I don't know what it is yet. And my inclination is to think that's something we need to change. It doesn't make sense if somebody's got a financial debt from previous semesters or even from the current semester in some way to then lock them out of the ability to start to address that in part through earning. So I'm with you entirely on that, and we will definitely explore that with the hope of making a change.
Perfect. Before I go to the gallery, I wanted to ask a question that we got from the University Assembly earlier this week. One of the representatives asked how financial aid is different for international students on campus, and also if there's a move for financial aid to be need-based for international students.
Sure. Well, we do have need-based international students. The big difference for international students is in the admissions process, where we are not need-blind for international students. So the chance of an international student getting admitted if they are also need-based drop significantly, and international students aren't admitted in as large a percentage anyway. Cornell has committed to a pretty significant budget. I think it places Stilis among the top 10 universities for international financial aid. It was budgeted this year at $13.4 million, and we've actually afforded $14.1 million because of the increase in enrollment that was there. We have done what I think is one really important thing with international students, which is that we no longer define DACA and undocumented students as international. If they graduated alongside other American students in American high schools, we think they deserve the same potential access for the admission process without being subject to the extra round of review. We do meet international student financial aid, and in some ways their financial aid packages are better. We don't include loans. They all need health insurance, and if the health insurance, if they're aided, that health insurance is paid for them in a way that it's not, because American students are understood to get that from their parents' employer. So there are some good benefits for international students, and then there's this one very significant constraint.
Perfect, thank you so much. So now I'm gonna go to the gallery for any gallery questions. Okay, Zoom? Nope, okay, an SA member? Representative Linga.
Hey, thank you for coming. I just had a quick question for you. So I know you mentioned emergency funds that the financial aid office is offering to people who need to pay rent or need to pay groceries. I just wanted to know, are there any steps that are planned by the financial aid office to publicize that further to students? Because I know a lot of students on campus, my constituents, who are like, would benefit from those policies, who they and I, this is our first time hearing about this in general.
Sure.
So are there any steps that the Commissioner's office has taken to do that?
Thank you for the question, because this rests right on a conversation that I had with my director of financial aid today, and he raised the same problem that my other director had raised a year ago. And at this point, I said, we're shutting down that problem. The problem is the people who have to calculate whether there's an availability for an emergency grant are the same people that are reading the packages and trying to get the information out. There's just not a dedicated resource to one of those functions that's different from the rest. So it hits a financial aid council. We have exactly 7 people right now who are capable of reading these applications and making awards. They're also the ones that would have to make the determination. But what Director Jensen and I agreed today was that when a student comes saying, I have an emergency, or when they apply on the website for the emergency funding, they just will rotate to the top of the queue. It's my hope that I can trust that students won't abuse that and claim an emergency that doesn't exist. We all know that that temptation will be great for people who are anxious and feel like they need something, but we would like to really prioritize those where rent is unpaid, groceries can't be purchased, the people that are sort of facing a relatively existential crisis on this rather than those who are not. So if that understanding is shared and socialized and embraced by Cornell students, we'll get through the emergencies and it will help us get some good work done at the highest urgent priority. Like I said, we already knew this by prioritizing off-campus living students over on-campus, but there's probably more that needs to be done.
Thank you. So I know we just had quite a few people walk in, so I just wanted to reiterate procedure on how this meeting is going. We're running on a 45-minute speaking time. There's going to be 1 minute for questions and a 1:30 response from VP Burdick. I am going in the order of an SA member, the gallery, and then the Zoom chat. And now we're at the gallery. Is there anyone who has a question? Perfect. And you'll be designated by VP Banza for questions.
Is this on?
Yeah. So when you take the microphone, can you please just say your name and then you can give us your comment?
Hi, my name is Geronimo Pinto. I'm a sophomore. I'm here on behalf of POC USAS number 3. So we were just wondering if the financial aid office was aware of the ongoing student discontent with financial aid problems, and also if they had any response to the protests at Day Hall 2 weeks ago. Obviously, I'm sure everybody knows that a lot of people haven't gotten their financial aid packages, and there's a lot of people that have gotten them, and they're substantially lower than they ever have been. So we're just wondering what the financial aid office's response was to the ongoing kind of student demonstrations and new involvement in demonstrations and kind of like campus politics around this these issues with financial aid.
Sure, and I'll just repeat a couple of things I said. It may have been before you came in the room. I'm excited about student demonstrations and protests. I went to attend and watch the entire thing. There's a whole variety of issues that the group was confronting, some of which belong in financial aid and some of which are different. Basically, what I said at the beginning was we are not where we want to be with financial aid, with student services. And if I were a student, I'd be complaining too, both on my own personal behalf and on behalf of everybody else. So I'm here to gather as much information as I can from what students think is the best way to approach student services and communication and to get better. So yes, full awareness and full support for the protesters in every way.
I'm not sure what my time constraints are here.
So you just asked a question. We're going through the speaking list. So the next time we'll come back.
Thank you so much.
Okay, so now the Zoom chat. Okay, yes. So if you were in the Zoom chat and you would like to respond with a question, can you please DM the question to Noah Watson, who is on the call? Because he's not able to see that question. I'm gonna take an SA member and then I'll come back to the Zoom chat. Okay, Representative Katie.
Thank you so much for coming here. I appreciate taking time out of your schedule for this. I had a couple questions, but I'll start with this one. You talked about financial aid not succeeding right now. I think, and you laid out many good examples from the pandemic to issues with staffing. things I think a lot of members here are sympathetic towards. I'm curious though, if you could talk a little bit more about what succeeding looks like from the financial aid office, and then what role the student assembly could play in that. And then to kind of compare that towards past years where you consider maybe we have succeeded or failed before. I think a lot of us students are coming from the perspective of right now seeing students not getting their financial aid, and we'd like to see more your vision of what a financial aid office succeeding looks like and how students can be involved with that, if possible.
So the primary area for student involvement, the focus I think will be on what students receive from financial aid in terms of services and communications. It's not so much on the table to say that students will be able to say what they think their financial aid package should be. That's a different order of magnitude. I'm not saying students shouldn't be involved in that, but it takes longer to change financial aid policies and awarding plans. And of course, that then you pull in the university budget and other resources. So just distinguishing between those two, there's nothing stopping us from using students as our basis to understand what services and communications to do. I thought what we would do is two things this fall, a broad survey and then focus groups to get more at the meat of what has been missing or absent or insecure about the processes we offer, and then use that to guide what our priorities are in applying fixes. That's what the new deputy director would be doing, the deputy director for undergraduate student services, as his sort of first order of business coming on board starting tomorrow.
Thank you.
Noah, were you able? Okay, perfect. So now I'm gonna go to the gallery.
My name is Annie Stutz. So I, like a lot of students, have yet to receive my financial aid package. And I know for myself, I have a special needs brother, and my mom is currently in a debacle of, does she pay for his care in full or worry about my tuition and if I get to continue going to Cornell? So my question is, do you have a date on when you think packages will be released or not?
Yeah, I have at this point an estimate. I think the basic package, whether it's right or wrong, would come in the next couple of weeks. We're down through that queue to do. As somebody mentioned from the essay, we've also got students that have to appeal beyond their first cut. That takes a little bit longer.
If we haven't received our first package at all.
If you haven't received your first package at all, there's two things that might be true. Well, really three. One is we put a financial aid estimate on your Bursar account that is preventing it from, that meaning it shouldn't be getting consequences, late fees and things like that. Or there's supposed to have been a communication to you. There's 270 students in the status where we need to resolve a piece of information that's not the same between two of your documents. Everybody should be in one or the other of those two statuses at this point, and not just simply not hearing at all. If you've not heard at all, that would be a different piece of news than what I had in my source of information from the director.
Thank you. So now I'm gonna go to the Zoom chat. Nothing, perfect. An SA member, Representative Hoy.
Hey, how you doing?
Hi.
Just a quick one. I'm not sure I was understanding. You said that Cornell was in a financial aid crisis before 2019, before the pandemic. Like, could you explain what happened or how that happened?
Sure. The thing I would tie it to most is Cornell's complexity. We have to fold in information, not just from here at Ithaca, but also the Weill Cornell campus, which runs its own financial aid operation. There had been some misreporting on the Cornell data about what our financial aid expenditures were. The chief area of misreporting was in the Perkins loan, a program that's since been discontinued that almost nobody in here, I think, would have been part of. That's been resolved. We've resolved that one big source of problem, but there were other kinds of compliance initiatives. As an example, we don't have uniformity in how Cornell colleges report when a student drops out or quits for a semester. And you actually have to calculate that very carefully as a share of the total time towards the enrollment period, because we have to return Title IV funds, loans, grant, Pell Grants, work study awards, if a student's not using them all up. Cornell did not have solid procedures for managing that data flow from the colleges and their registrars all the way through to the financial aid office and that reporting function. We're making progress on that, but there's a total of more than 200 computer system fixes to get us into the realm of where we are truly able to be compliant. And that's ongoing work. It's been severely delayed by COVID because we've had to do other things. So that's the crisis I'm talking about. It wasn't that students weren't getting aid. It wasn't that Cornell wasn't awarding aid in the way that it wanted, but we were not reporting out on our aid to the federal government and the other agencies in the way that we should have been.
Thank you, appreciate it.
Okay, I'm gonna take a question from the gallery.
Hello, my name is Samantha Ivey. I'm a sophomore this year. The question I have for you, I heard what you were saying earlier about not having resources to deal with the financial aid crisis as of right now, but I'm just wondering what steps are being taken in the future to make sure this doesn't happen again, and also making sure that there are resources in the future to deal with potential financial aid crises.
Sure. When I think of resources, I just want to mention two things. One is the personnel and their training. We've made good progress on that. We've hired to fill 12, and it'll soon be 14 out of the empty 16 positions that had existed a year ago. So good progress on hiring a new leadership, a new director, and a new deputy director. The other resource is a little more complicated. Cornell's student system is not optimized to support financial aid, which means we're doing a lot of workarounds and modifications to be successful. That's a longer term question, but it's a really important one. Right now, we actually have to spend a little more money on salary to get over the hump of systems that don't support exactly what we want to do. So Cornell's just not in the best position it could be with system support. That's a longer term question and potentially millions of dollars. So it's a little bit farther than above my pay grade to resolve all by myself.
So what steps?
But to tell you the truth, I would very much love to have student input about the services and the constraints and the challenges they're facing, because I think that becomes part of a valuable rationale for why we want to pay for systems improvements or why we want to expand personnel.
Thank you. Okay, now I'll go to Zoom. Nothing? Okay. SA representatives, Representative Baker.
Hello, thank you for coming today. So I appreciate your solutions of hiring more people and communicating better, but how are we going to make sure in the future that deadlines are met and that the office is holding themselves accountable to actually meet those deadlines and provide students with those packages before the semester begins?
At this point, my solution is just that brute force solution that when you only have 7 people doing the work that you really need 12 people to do, you've got to get those 12 people going and teach them how to do it so that the work actually gets done. I think at the individual level of financial aid office, there's been no lack of accountability. People have been working very hard. We have people who've done thousands of reviews just on their own, just to make sure that we got out as much as we could. But the collective resource that the financial aid office has needed has been missing for at least a year. And I think this actually predates that in some ways. My personal interaction with them said, let's get the hiring done. Let's make that a priority to a degree that was not true in the years prior to me being here. So that's my only real good solution. Let's get good people in and train them. I don't have another solution. There are other things that you could think about doing. We could make Cornell's financial aid administration less complex. We could simply add more personnel so that the timing is more assured on a seasonal basis. But we have not discussed any of those solutions in any depth yet.
Thank you. So now I'm gonna go to the gallery.
Hi, my name is Malcolm Olson, I'm a sophomore. So I've heard discussion already. We've talked about what's going to be done in the future to avoid this kind of thing. But a lot of damage has already been done now. I know lots of kids who, for example, were waiting on their financial aid refunds in order to make rent. So is the financial aid going to do anything to remedy the damage that has already been caused?
Anything that would normally be a charge that you get from the Cornell bill, I think we've already made a pledge that we will waive late registration fees. There will be no accrual of late fees for students, so that, that anything that's in Cornell's control is there. If somebody's facing a consequence from a landlord or some other debtor out there, I think that's a conversation to have with a specific financial aid counselor to make sure that a student in that circumstance goes to the top of the priority list to get that resolved.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Zoom, okay. SI members? Representative Leon?
Hi, so thank you for coming to speak to us. I guess my question is just, why does the burden, or I guess a lot of the burden, fall on the students to keep going to day hall and reminding administrators to do this? I understand that there is a staffing crisis, and obviously like the people working on this aren't the people with the power to change everything, but why is the burden being placed on the students who should be focused on studying and not on like pressuring the people who do have the power to do this, like the Board of Trustees and the president, to do things like institute a tuition freeze or like waiving the unjust policies like what we were just talking about with the bursar holds?
So I'll only say again, with a tuition freeze, that's just outside of my expertise. I've never been in a situation where a tuition freeze was a suggested solution. It has not come up in any of my conversations. I can see where it makes sense in some way, but it isn't something that's been in my purview, and I don't know. That would seemingly maybe take a board action to do. In terms of the other kinds of responses, the president and the provost are aware, they're supportive. They have been part of my strategy to get the hiring done and to get this fixed from a staffing standpoint. To be honest, I don't think any student needs to go to day hall to remind an administrator to work. They're already working their tails off really hard. I think it's very fine for a student to go and say, I still have a source of continuing anxiety about the fact that my financial aid is not done. And even in any way to convey that, the protest was great. Any kind of consequences that you're feeling, we need to know those. We want to share those burdens with you. But the only solution is the people that know how to do the work. There's no magical list of people out there that know how to do a Cornell financial aid package that we haven't already tapped.
Thank you. Now I'm going to go to the gallery. Hi, my name's Katrina. So a single dorm anywhere on campus costs $11,281. Cornell recently released its decision to require sophomores next year to live on campus, regardless of financial status. Given the strain on the financial aid office evident in your testimony, why would the university make this decision now to require sophomores to live on campus? And will housing costs go down?
I'm not in charge of housing costs, so I'll have to leave that in the hands of others that you know, like Vice President Lombardi. My understanding is that the decision to move to sophomore required housing actually goes back 10 years or more and was sort of part of the reason that they created the new space in the North Campus Residential Extension in the first place. So that seemed to have come from a determination about that students are better served by living. And of course, when they say on campus, they're including program houses, fraternities, and sororities, not just the actual dorms themselves and the associated charges. I don't know if I hit all the parts of your question. Was there another element to it? I forgot. I'll be honest with you, my guess is absolutely not. They've just experienced the price of building all this new space, and I don't think that they're gonna find any mechanism that's available that's gonna actually reduce those charges. I will say that for a need-based financial aid student, in essence, the price won't make a difference, meaning if the price were to go up $4,000, then your financial aid eligibility would also go up $4,000, and in most cases, there's not a source to make you meet that other than grant. It's actually the students that are paying the full price that will potentially be getting a larger cost. There is an interesting dimension at Cornell. I'm gonna run out of time. But there's an interesting dimension at Cornell. Cornell officially assumes that the cost of living off campus and on campus is the same. I don't know if that's true. That's not a question that's been researched recently enough for me to feel secure about it.
That's not your time for that one, I'm so sorry. Sorry, we are at Zoom? Nothing? Okay, essay. Representative Jang.
First of all, thank you very much for coming here, Vice Paul with Gordon. So my question to you is, I wonder where's the sources of financial aid come from Cornell? So to be specific, so let's say if there's increment in the future of financial aid to different students, where those money going to come from? Are they going to come from the tuitions of the students who pay full tuitions, or are they going to come from the Cornell endowment?
There's no direct relationship here. There's three sources of income, if you will, for Cornell that operates its budget. One is the payment out of endowment. That's going well. Another is payment from other kinds of ancillary expenses and research. So when somebody gets a research grant, there's an overage amount that's given to them to pay for the infrastructure, and that helps support Cornell in a big, big way. Only about a third of Cornell's total revenue is net tuition. So that's the tuition that we collect net of the financial aid that we spend. I don't see that changing. I think that those sources will continue to be the three sources, and any financial aid we give will still be rooted basically in all three of those. It's not independently budgeted.
So essentially, so we'll-
Representative Jang, I'll come back to you on a second okay. speakers list. Okay, now I'm gonna go to the gallery.
Hi, so my question is, are there any planned reforms to the financial aid process for those with difficult family circumstances? So Cornell requires me to go through the CSS profile to submit my non-custodial parents' income. They pay child support. I've never lived with them in my life. And because of this, I'm taking out loans for their expected contribution. So the only way I can get around this is through submitting court documents or proving that I became an independent as a minor. Is there not any other way for Cornell to consider these difficult family circumstances?
So the answer to that is a bit of a yes and a no. We're required to follow guidelines when it comes to how we decide how much aid a student is eligible for. There is some flexibility, what's called professional judgment in those guidelines. And there is an opportunity, I think, to revisit what Cornell does in the circumstances you're describing, where we've got a non-custodial parent and they're either refusing to pay or that we can't access their information. So I think the answer is yes. There is actually a win that's been gathered in the last 2 years, which is about 2,000 continuing students have not been required to file a CSS profile after their first year. And that's because their financial picture is pretty simple and we can just duplicate it from 1 year to the next without a change. There's an intent to make more of that because that'll make more of the packages flow faster. This year was a little over 2,000 students if that was the case out of the total 9,000. The idea is to expand that. So hopefully, if you spend your first year proving that you've not got the non-custodial parent income on your side, that can be more or less automatically renewed for all the subsequent years. That would be a kind of innovation I think you're talking about that would be helpful.
Thank you. Okay, Nozium, any SA representatives? Okay, I'm gonna start a second speakers list for SA, Representative Mullen.
So just to bring up on the subject of the financial aid crisis and the misreporting of the financial aid, it seems really bizarre to me that we can go to a school with a $7.8 billion endowment. We just got a $50 million donation to the hotel school, but we can't properly report our own financial aid for students who need it. And reading some of these testimonies, students feel deeply humiliated. Some of the students report being told false information, aid workers trying to convince them that they're lying, being dismissive of them. So I guess my question is just, is there a way in which, I completely get that they're overworked, but when they're giving responses, as rare as that is, the responses are inadequate and oftentimes simply just rude. So I'm wondering if there's some kind of internal culture within the financial aid office that needs to change to give more adequate and more respectful answers to the students.
I think that's a really good question. I don't find a culture like that, a toxic culture like that, in how they think about their work and what they do. I think it may be an outgrowth of just the sheer quantity and volume of what they've had to do at a pace over a period of time. None of the behaviors you're describing are acceptable. They can't ignore, they can't be rude, they can't tell students that they're lying. And it would be my goal to change that in every possible way. Again, something I would like to draw on
the help and guidance of students to make sure that that's true.
Thank you. Now I'll go to the gallery.
Hello, so you've previously mentioned that a lot of the source of concern for this is the lack of qualified people to send out financial aid. And I was just wondering why this is having such a crisis this year as opposed to other years. Has there been an uptick in the amount of work that these people have had to be doing? Or has there been, have a lot of them quit? This could have been answered previously. I just would like to know.
Sure. It's actually kind of a classic perfect storm. There's been a greater volume of activity needed, a smaller number of people available to do it, and an increased complexity of what they're doing. So, for instance, appeals are up because 2020 income was very different from 2019 income because of the COVID crisis. The COVID crisis, I think, was at part of the root of why the staff were leaving in such large numbers during the calendar year 2020. And there has been an increase in the volume. That one of the unexpected bonuses, I guess, of Cornell's large success in managing COVID is that a lot of students who stayed out a year ago for hybrid education have come back for in-person instruction this year. It's on the one hand great, they're continuing their Cornell career, but it does dramatically increase the volume of work that financial aid has to do just when we didn't have as many staff to do it.
Okay, cool. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Soon. Okay, SA representatives. Representative Katie.
Two mics, thank you. Can you hear me? All right. Thanks for the opportunity again to speak one more time. I'd kind of like to take a step back a little bit towards the direction of earlier conversation about really resources for students. We talked earlier, you talked earlier about the difficulty in the process of financial aid. I, as a student with financial aid, can certainly speak to that, as I think many of the other people who've spoken previously could say the same. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about the current student resources for communication and review within financial aid, and how beyond staff limitations we can expect to see that change in the future, or as the student assembly, we can assist that process.
Sure. So right now we have 6 new financial aid counselors. It's essentially the entire complement, in effect, of the financial aid counseling staff. So almost 100% turnover at that level. We have only 2 of 4 funded positions for frontline transactions. So that's the people at the desk looking at the email, answering the calls. The big consequence we're facing right now is that the counseling staff who are great are not yet trained. You have to go through a cycle of financial aid to really understand what Cornell is doing and to enact it. So we've used those 6 people to address the frontline services and cleared out a whole bunch of outside agency scholarship checks that had arrived to answer more of the questions, to just even look at those emails. We were 1,200 behind in emails at one point. So we've taken the resource we have that's not available to do the work we need them to do ultimately, while we train them and have them address the other question that was there. None of those are long-term solutions. Those are Band-Aid solutions. Long-term, we need to be better at deciding what are the priority claims on the time for communications and services, and then make sure we're staffed to support those.
Thank you. I'll take the next question from the gallery.
Hi there. So one of the points you've mentioned a couple times is that there's been an issue with staffing in terms of financial aid, and that's what's prevented people from getting their financial aid information. What was the reason for being so understaffed right now, and what is Cornell doing to make sure that sort of thing never happens again?
Well, I like the second question because I don't have an answer to it, so you're giving me pause for thought. I would say my theory of management is that you make sure staff understand they're supported and you train them to learn what they need to learn to do their work. I would say that that's underway with the counseling staff, with a new manager and a new leadership in that area. Could I tell you that that's definitely gonna keep Cornell on an even keel? Not 100%. I think we need more backups and redundancies in our staffing to be sure that that's the case. I know one way that it won't work, which is that if we lean into the financial aid staff and tell them things they're doing wrong all the time, that doesn't give them much hope of doing better. So I hope that we can lean back and support the staff, especially those that have been working really hard for a long time to do this, and give them a chance to see if they can sort of make a break in the current pattern and get it better. I think we have to sort of turn the entire culture upside down that way.
Thank you.
Thank you. Just so everyone has a time check, we have 9 minutes left on the clock. I'll go to Zoom. Nothing? Okay. SA representatives. Representative Langa.
Thank you. So I do have another question for you. So I know that there seems to be, from this discussion, a big disconnect between what the Board of Trustees and Martha thinks that the students or that financial aid can do, what the students and the student body expects from the financial aid department, and what the financial aid department, limited by resources and capacity, actually can do. And I know you've talked about wanting more student involvement with some of these processes, getting students in on this conversation. And I know you also mentioned that, you know, Martha Pollack and the Board of Trustees are aware of the situation and what's going on. We were introduced to Martha when we got inducted at the very beginning. We asked her, it was the only time she's come to meet the student assembly. We asked her about the financial aid crisis. She said, in her own words, she said that she wasn't aware that the crisis was still ongoing and that she would get back to it. So obviously that represents like a clear lapse in
That's
communication.
That's your time, thank you.
I was just gonna ask, can you make a commitment to working with students moving forward and getting us in on these conversations?
It's the only thing I wanna do. Remember, my role is not directly financial aid, that's the new director's purview. So he's the one coming up with the actual solutions. I think my role is to make sure that the president and the provost are aware, beyond them, the board, and that the students are my primary source of information about services and communications in particular. So I'll make that my personal pledge. That's my responsibility and my pledge moving forward entirely. I think the president was caught by surprise about the fact that there were students whose packages were still not done. I just chalk that up to, we just didn't have an independent conversation about this during the month of August. Remember, a lot of these packages that are now not yet done were only completed during August. So there was just not a reconnoitering point as we got into the school year.
Thank you. Now I'll go to the gallery.
This is a tall microphone, okay. Hi there, my name is Logan Morales. I'm a student manager in two units in Cornell Dining. The financial aid crisis is starting to pose a problem for operations in dining as well, because there's an understaffing crisis in dining units, and I cannot hire people who have holds on their account. One person I was going to hire told me that their hold was resolved, but they're still waiting for it to be like removed from their system. And to my knowledge, it still hasn't. So I can't put them into payroll because there's absolutely no reason that an enrolled student should not be allowed to be hired because of the fact that they haven't received their financial aid yet. And because students need to be able to work now to, you know, pay for their livelihood. Will you address this issue with financial aid or speak to those who have jurisdiction on this? Also, I haven't got my financial aid, so if you could ask them to send that my way, that'd be great.
Come see me and I'll write your name down. So since this has come up twice and I had the same reaction that you did, and I believe someone over here did about this question, I will make that my first priority tomorrow. I think the people I need to ask are the bursar, because they're the ones who put the hold on. Mm-hmm. We run student employment, and from our standpoint, there's no reason for an enrolled student to not be able to be employed, even while they have a hold on their finances. So I truly do not understand why that's a policy. It was not a policy at any place I worked before. Maybe we can get a quick resolution on that one.
Thank you so much.
Sure.
Okay, Zoom. Okay, I'll go to SA members. Representative
Jiang. All right, thank you very much. My question was a follow-up question of my previous question regarding the transfer of burdens of the financial aid. So here's the background information. So in the past year, or during the 2020 coronavirus pandemic, the economic situation is completely shifting in the world, whereas in the economics around the international world has been crumbling. And also, as Representative Mullen previously mentioned, that because the US stock market is doing fantastic well, the endowment grow a lot. So my question is, if in the future there is the increment of financial aid need, are the monetary sources are going to primarily come from the increase of tuitions, or are they going to come from the endowment?
So the sources that come in are not exactly match the source of the Goel. So there's no plan to say we're going to increase tuition by this much, therefore aid will increase by that much. Aid increases at Cornell based on student need. What's going to happen next year, so next fall enrollment, is people are going to be showing on average more need because their 2020 income was down. That's at all levels, but especially at the lowest income levels. So we're going to be pumping more financial aid forward than students actually need at that point. Some people are going to be getting a richer package than they would actually need because their family circumstances have changed that much. Right now we're in the opposite situation. We're looking at a 2019 year that was relatively good, and we're having students coming in based on the 2020 and 2021 year that sometimes was not very good, which is why the appeals go way up. So there's just sort of a roller coaster flow to financial aid that we can't, especially in the pandemic and economic crisis, we can't automatically fix it. But there's no constraint on the financial aid budget based on how much tuition goes up at all. The financial aid budget floats on its own level based on the policies that we have.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. And as we're nearing the end, I'm gonna do one more gallery question and then one more question from the SI. So now we're at the gallery.
Hello, okay. So on the topic of holds for employment, I just got hired for a job and Nicole McPherson, who is the coordinator for work study, is saying that I don't have federal work study funds. However, I have gotten my tuition, I have gotten my financial aid letter, and so I don't know if this is just an idiosyncrasy on the financial aid end or what's happening, but I should have been onboarding on my job and I can't.
So it's up to the employer about whether they require a student employee to have a work study or not. It's not a requirement that we impose on them. They do it to save money because when you got work study, that pays for 50% of your wages that the employer then doesn't have to pay out of their budget. I can't stop an employer from wanting to hire students who have a work study award.
I do have a work study award.
Okay.
It's just the coordinator for work study and the financial aid department is having some miscommunication where they're saying okay. I don't, but I see that on my end.
I would really appreciate if you come see me. I can write that down and we can see if we can put that forward for a fix really fast. Because if you have work study funds coming to you, mm-hmm. that's coming from an outside block grant from the feds, there's no reason whatsoever for the financial aid office to want to hold that.
Thank
you. We'll try to get that cleared up.
Thank you. And this will be the last question from the SI. Okay, that's going to be a third speaker's list. Okay. Representative Valencia.
Hi, so thank you for coming here to speak with us. I know in the past there's been conversations regarding the possibility for financial aid to waive like the summer student contribution requirement for low-income students or other like students like seeking like non-funded, non-paid summer programs and stuff. So I'm just kind of wondering like where your like the Office of Financial Aid, like where the stance is on that.
Sure, really glad to close on this question. So I had a meeting with the People's Organizing Collective when I first arrived in fall of 2019 and they raised this issue. We worked together on drafting an idea of an experimental program to waive summer savings expectation for students to be able to take unpaid internships that otherwise were expected to come up with funds during the summer. I'm really pleased to say that that experiment has been approved. Conceptually, we have to sort of build out what it actually looks like in practice. But that is an intention moving forward, that there will be up to 500 students a year or potentially more if it's partial relief who will be able to apply for a program in concert with the career services, perhaps with study abroad for summer experiences, with research, with Cornell engagement, Engage Cornell. More and more opportunities for students to say, I've got this experience, it doesn't pay in a way that allows me to come up with the $3,300 that Cornell expects, and we would waive all or part of that. So that's moving forward nicely as a plan.
Okay. Thank you so much, and thank you, VP Burdick, for coming to speak with us today. I know it means a lot to students to hear everything that's going on with financial aid on campus.
Your questions are exactly on point and wonderful, and I hope we have many, many more meetings. Next time I'll bring my communications director and my financial aid director and we'll dig into any details that we can resolve as fast as we can, either with this group or with some subcommittee or anybody you'd like to spin up. Thank you very much for the time.
Thank you. Now I'm going to go to our next announcement and report. That is a byline announcement from from Representative Baker.
Motion to amend the agenda to place the byline announcement after Resolution 30.
Second. Okay. So we are going to move into initiatives. Any initiatives? Perfect. Now we are going to. Do you want to amend for, or actually, okay. Okay. I'm going to go to Representative Lango.
Yeah, actually, never mind.
Okay, I would highly smile upon a motion to move Resolution 30 to the next thing on our agenda. Representative Katie.
I motion to move Resolution 30 to the next thing on the agenda.
Second,
perfect. Any dissent to that? Okay, we're gonna start with Resolution 30.
Hello. So I realize that I have never formally introduced myself, so I'll start with that. Greetings, I hope you're all well. My name is Yunenui or She Guards the Corn, and I am dear friend of the Seneca Nation. Della, would you like to introduce yourself?
Hello, Buju, Benesu, Kwenindigo, Makwenindudem, Gawababukankak, and Dunjaba. I'm Della. I'm a senior in environment sustainability, former co-chair of NASAC, and Yanenui's name mentor. I also helped with this.
So I would just like to introduce the resolution to you. It's really important for me to be up here with and in front of you all today. Canada has marked today its first official National Day for Truth and Reconciliation. The U.S. unofficially recognizes today as the National Day of Remembrance for U.S. Indian boarding schools, both of which embody what I present to you today as Orange Shirt Day. Through this resolution, I call for Cornell University to declare Orange Shirt Day an official day of recognition and solidarity. I call for the promotion of educational resources and an acknowledgement of the rising numbers of children's remains currently being recovered at boarding and residential schools in present day U.S. and Canada. When I speak with you about boarding in residential schools, I need you to understand that we're not far removed, as most of our grandparents and parents were sent to these institutions of assimilation. This includes conversion to Christianity, the removal of long hair, clothes, and native tongue, the mental, physical, and sexual assault many, if not most, have endured. For those of you that aren't unfamiliar with the gravity this day holds, I encourage you to do research and listen to all of the work of Indigenous leaders, writers, directors, and all of which I propose in this resolution. Because of the platform I occupy and share with you today, I find it necessary to bring awareness to the issues that directly impact this university's Indigenous students. We have an inherent obligation to our communities and ancestors to not allow this to be swept under the rug. So with this resolution, I'm putting the ball in your court. Nyawe, thank you. Oh, I would also like to amend that we include Adele Williams and Kurt Jordan to co-sponsor this resolution, and a signed endorsement by NASAC, the Native American Indigenous Students at Cornell.
Second, okay. Do we have any dissent to that? Perfect, your amendment holds. I will now pass it over to questions and comments. I'd just like to start by thanking you all for coming today, bring this resolution to the floor. Representative Mullen.
Yeah, also just a huge thank you for bringing this forward. And I would just kind of add on to this that there should be some kind of effort. I think a lot of us have been seeing recently the labels being put on the ground at Cornell, saying what it is of stolen land. And I think that there should be a continued effort in the student assembly to continue addressing this and getting Cornell to fess up to its crimes in the past. So thank you for bringing this forward.
Thank you.
Representative Lieberman. Do we have a second to that? Second, okay. She did. Okay. do we have any dissent to that? Perfect. So can I have all those in favor, please raise your placards. Okay, in a vote of 17-0-1, that resolution passes. Congratulations and thank you for coming.
Thank you.
Okay, we will now move back to announcements. We have Representative Baker discussing byline announcements.
Motion to amend the agenda to put the announcement after the presentation.
Do we have a second to that?
Second.
Perfect. Now we are going to have the Professional Fraternity Council. We'll have Angela Shi and Jennifer Zhang speaking with us.
Amazing. Can everyone hear me okay?
Can you hold the microphone to you?
Is this better?
Yes.
Perfect. Okay, amazing. Thank you so much for having me here today to briefly introduce myself. My name is Jennifer. I'm a senior in the Dyson School, and I'm one of the co-presidents of the Professional Fraternity Council. So unfortunately, my co-president, Angela Shi, had to leave early, so I'll be presenting on the behalf of both of us. So this request and presentation is with regards to the Professional Fraternity Council's series Appendix B writing, which is kind of the requirements that allows the Professional Fraternity Council to gain funding. So I would like to request revision of some of these statements that was sent to us. So my reasoning for that is because the Professional Fraternity Council is still in its infancy stage. So we are currently in the third year since the founding of PFC. And our goal as an organization is to unite the different professional fraternities and hold events like the PFC Fair that introduces students to different types of professional organizations that are on campus. So as such, much of the incentives for PFOs to join our Professional Fraternity Council is to gain exposure to students who are interested in professional development and while also getting the chance for PFOs to collaborate with each other. So therefore, we would like to request a revision of the Appendix B wording to the following. So this is in point three, where it says that professional fraternity organizations can choose to be a part of the PFC at the beginning of each academic year. So PFOs are only eligible for funding through the PFC and not other byline funded organizations such as SCFC. If PFOs choose to participate in the PFC, then they must abide by the following guidelines. So the first point says that we will have a survey for potential new members that want to join a professional organization that collects demographic data. And point two is that we will send out a standardized form to PFOs regarding diversity statistics if they are available. And point three is that if the diversity statistics are provided, then PFC will publish all of that information on the PFC website. So moving on, point four is about consent ed. So for this, we're having each PFO schedule a consent ed presentation at least once every calendar year, and they must have at least 80% of their new members in attendance for the presentation, and PFC won't disperse any funds to any PFO that doesn't meet the 80% attendance requirement. So our last point is that PFC will request that chapter dues be disclosed by each PFO. And this information will be posted on the PFC website as well as on individual PFO applications. So the reasoning behind these changes is because if we force PFOs to provide information about their new members and publish them online in exchange for this community and funding, then they might actually choose to exit the organization and instead rely on their own funding. So many of the PFOs are already self-sustaining and therefore don't necessarily require student assembly funding. So PFC has seen great success in the past by holding social events such as the one between DSP, AIR, and Theta Tau Trivia Night. So there were over 100 plus people in attendance at that event, and this will be a tradition that does continue into the future. So further, PFC is well aware that it may be uncomfortable for some student organizations that where they don't want to share this particular information about demographic statistics with us, just because of the fact that we are a student-run organization. So we know the importance of diversity, equity, and inclusion in terms of the professional organizations on campus, which is definitely one of our guiding principles. So we've been working towards this by having president's roundtables and also DE&I chair roundtables each semester. And in these roundtables, we discuss recruitment, unconscious biases, and then we also recognize that many PFOs are also in the initial stages of enacting policies and practices which work towards more diverse new member classes and organizations in general. And in doing so, we're hoping to address the pipeline problem. So I would really appreciate and ask that the Student Assembly remove wording about requiring members of PFOs to provide their personal background and information. So instead of having the word requirements, we would respectfully request that PFOs provide us information on their demographic statistics. So we're definitely happy to consolidate and publish information about PFOs that they provide to us, but we also do not want to restrict funding from organizations that are not comfortable sharing that information with the student governing body. One of the biggest incentives that PFC has to ask and collect demographic data and also encourage people to talk to each other about how they can improve their recruitment practices is by providing them the incentive of funding. Thank you.
Thank you. So now I'll open it to question and comment. Representative Overton.
Hi, thank you for coming to speak with us today. I'm trying to find a way to phrase this. I respectfully disagree with your last statement. As a woman, underrepresented woman of color myself, who's in professional counsel, I think that it is important for these orgs to disclose that information, because I don't know how many of you remember last year, but there was a student who came forward about, a Black student who came forward about how they felt kind of mistreated by one of the PFC orgs. And personally, I think that there's nothing to hide there. I don't see if the university reports its diversity statistics too, like a lot of other organizations do. Like, I personally don't think that there's anything to hide. Like, you know, you're not gonna get less funding if you don't have like a certain amount of, so like, this isn't a quota, you know, like you're not gonna get reduced funding if you don't disclose the demographics. If a student is uncomfortable disclosing their personal identity themselves, you could just have them like check like another like undisclosed option. But personally, I think those statistics are important to report so we can see who's getting admitted, especially into some of these clubs that claim to be like the best, more, most exclusive. And, you know, if you're getting excluded based on things that you can't control, the mutable factors like your race, like your hair texture, like if you have braids, if you're a Black person. I just, again, respectfully disagree with your request. And I would like to encourage my fellow Student Assembly members to keep the wording as it is. Thank you.
Sorry. I was just gonna let you know, Jennifer, that you can respond to any comments you have.
Yeah, thank you so much for your comment. That definitely is something that we view of the utmost importance, and it's something that our executive board has been trying to change. So I think I would like to just say that PFC isn't trying at all to, you know, have organizations be able to hide if they have any bad recruitment practices or if they have a very non-diverse organization. So what I'm trying to say is that organizations don't necessarily require student assembly funding. It's more of an incentive that once they join the organization, like once they join the Professional Fraternity Council, they'll be able to have a bigger reach and a bigger scope. And in doing so, one of the requirements that we have is that if they want any extra funding from us, then they do have to publish their demographic statistics. So diversity, equity, and inclusion is one of the biggest proponents of our agenda moving forward. And we're really, really trying to fix that problem. But I think that one of the biggest ways, since with the carrot and the stick analogy, there isn't a way that we can really punish these organizations for not publishing that information. So the best thing that we can do right now is offer funding as an incentive, where in the future, if they disclose their information to us, Obviously, it's completely anonymized, and we don't point out any specific fraternity in particular, but then that these fraternities can recognize that they may have an issue within their own organizations, and then in the future, talk to different student leaders on campus to rectify that problem.
Thank you. Representative Leon.
So thank you for coming to speak to us. I'm VP of D&I for the PFO that I'm in. So I do have a couple of thoughts. I agree with everything that Nicole said. I don't think that this is coming from any place of like I think you guys' hearts are in the right place, but I would have to disagree with most of this. So two main points. The point about people being uncomfortable, like reporting their own demographics to students, I feel like that's pretty void given that the form that we're required to put on the apps doesn't ask for name, and you have the option to put prefer not to say or other. So if you're uncomfortable giving a specific piece of information, you don't have to. And the second is the addressing the pipeline thing. I think most people know that Cornell is predominantly white and wealthy. That's not really a secret. Like if you're a minority trying to join a minority oriented organization, you're probably gonna go to the likes of like Black Ivy or CLAP, which is Cornell Latinx Association of Pre-Laws. So I feel like, and like Nicole said, like this can lead to, I guess, more harmful situations for students if they're not aware of the situations that they're walking into. So I would have to say that. And then the last thing, we mentioned the D&I like roundtables. I've participated in that as VP of D&I. I can't say that I think that it does much for the pipeline problem because we're not exactly like required to go back and like give that same talk again. So I feel very lucky that like the people that I work with are committed to D&I and they do like work with me and all of this stuff, like the stuff that we do or that we try to do. And I feel like if people are discouraged from doing this and they don't want this transparency, I feel like that's more of a separate issue than necessarily like the information that's being asked of people, if that makes sense.
Yeah, definitely. I think I caught most of it, but if there's anything that I missed, please feel free to just let me know. So I think the first thing is for your first point. So that's definitely an issue that's been brought up many times in the like president's organizations. We also have a roundtable that's specifically for business fraternity presidents because we recognize that some of the organizations are the ones that have been spoken out against in the past, and that I think is where a lot of the issues may lie. So in these deliberations, it's like we as PFC present information on what we believe are recruitment best practices, and we kind of encourage people to recognize that there are a lot of unconscious biases in terms of recruitment and deliberations, and we're just trying to make sure that I think this is going to be a problem, unfortunately, that continues and the solution will be a little bit slower. It won't be as dramatic of a change, no matter how much I would like that to happen. So I think in future semesters, I think that we really want to keep professional organizations within PFC because then at least they're being forced to participate in these talks and they're being and they have to have like, you know, notes taken back to them. They have recruitment best practices. They're constantly being reminded of what they should be doing as an organization and also some of the places where they might be lacking. So that's definitely one of the biggest reasons why. I know that the extra funding may not seem like a huge initiative, but I do think that it is a step in the right direction. And because PFC is so young of an organization, we really, really don't want any like organizations to be leaving the PFC umbrella just because they don't agree with our policies, if that makes sense. Yeah, did I miss anything?
Thank you. I'm gonna give a comment and a question and then we can go back to the debate. So as a comment, just for SA members, something that I would like to reiterate and just second Jennifer on, is the fact that I'm a member of a PFO and it is very easy for PFOs to leave the PFC. And there are some like really important diversity initiatives that I think PFC like provides to those PFOs. I know for one, my organization would not be doing consent ed training annually if they were not a member of PFC and have considered leaving PFC at a point. I think that's worth like acknowledging and thinking about when we're thinking about these questions as well. Okay, I will go to the next person. Representative Lieberman.
First, because I don't think I heard everything you said, would you mind just repeating that quickly?
Yes, I can reiterate that. I said just to consider Jennifer's point is that it is pretty easy for organizations to leave PFC, and there are some really important diversity initiatives that PFC requires organizations to be a part of that they wouldn't do. So I'm saying, for example, Consent Ed, my organization would not be doing Consent Ed training annually and could very easily just leave PFC. So I think that's something that we should be considering in this debate. And I think that's something that Jennifer has reiterated quite a few times. Also, I just got a comment that we are at 6:12 and our meeting ends in 18 minutes. So what I'm gonna do now, I know there's a lot of questions right now. I'm gonna do 30 second questions, 30 second responses. Okay, perfect. Sorry, I'm gonna let Carson bring up the timer. Perfect, Representative Katie, or actually I take it back. I'm gonna do 30 second questions, a minute response for you. Okay, Representative Katie.
Hi there. First, I'd like to thank you for coming out. I appreciate you wanting to communicate with the Student Assembly. I had originally a different imagination how I'd ask this question. So I think I'm gonna have to workshop it a little bit. Originally, I was gonna ask if you could share just a little bit more details about have any specific organizations refused to publish this information and have any specific organizations threatened to leave, just so we as the SA have a groundwork for that. But instead of that, I would just highlight that we'd encourage to you as like members of the SA really to bring these complaints forward to any sort of organizations within the administration as they occur if necessary, so that we can adjust accordingly towards issues of diversity, equity, and inclusion.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I don't know if I caught everything, but PFC is definitely happy to share information that we end up collecting. I know we have a report from two semesters ago about diversity, equity, and inclusion, and we will be happy to send that information over and see if there are any areas. So we personally hadn't noticed any very glaring issues in that report, but we would also be happy to send it over and just have some look at it and see if there's anything that we missed that you would like to address.
I'm gonna go to the next person and then we'll come back to you. Representative Jiang.
Hello, Jennifer. Thank you. First of all, thank you very much for coming here. As one of the reasons you mentioned why you want to amend it.
Can you speak into the microphone? Sorry.
As one of the reasons you mentioned to amend is because some of the organizations want to leave. So my question is, how many professional fraternity organizations currently in the professional fraternity councils and how many are not?
Oh, okay. Yeah, that's a good question that I can answer. So right now we have 13 under the umbrella and we have one professional organization that is looking to join but requires a vote within their general assembly body before they are allowed to officially join PFC. So as of right now, we are unsure if there are any other professional organizations on campus. We just recruited two within the last semester. So as of right now, we also have people from, or we have a faculty advisor from campus and student life that is looking through campus groups and trying to see if there are any organizations that we have missed. But to the fullest extent of my knowledge, I don't believe that there are.
So all of them are in your umbrella?
Yes, except one.
Okay. Representative Mullen.
Yeah, thank you. Just to kind of agree with what Nicole said earlier, I think that the question, the reason behind why we changed the wording is not so much about the individual initiatives that I am sure are really, really good, but it's more so the general culture, I think, of secrecy that pervades a lot of these organizations. I say that not being in Greek life or in a fraternity, but from my kind of outside perspective, it's a problem more of the culture and not so much about an individual kind of initiative that's being undergone. So my question would just be more, if we revert to the original wording as you want, how can we be sure that beyond any one initiative that the overall culture is being changed to be more in favor of transparency and not kind of secrecy in the past?
Yeah, 100%. And I totally understand that's a really valid concern. So I think from my end, we do have these roundtables that are happening, and we also have we have two different workshops that we want to have. First is consent ed, second is just hazing prevention workshops that occur every semester.
So I would be happy to have someone from my organization type up meeting notes or any reports or anything like that, and we can send it to student assembly members if they are interested in that. And apart from that, also student assembly members are more than welcome to sit in on any of these roundtables or discussions that we're going to have, if that helps. Yeah, I do understand that the secrecy is kind of a big thing that student organizations or business professional organizations have on campus. Definitely something that I'm looking forward to change. Also, I know each organization talks with their nationals branch and all the other branches, and they're kind of regulated in that way as well.
Thank you. Okay, given time, I'm gonna take two more questions. Call it a day. Representative Grohmeyer.
Good evening. I just wanted to ask about, like, what are the, can you reiterate like the main reasons why they'd wanna like leave, just because they don't wanna upload, you know, their statistics? Like, I don't know, I just feel like it's kind of like an easy cop out. Like, ah, we don't feel like, you know, do they not feel like doing it? Do they have to record it under the national organization, or is it just like not really something they're thinking about?
Yeah, so I am unclear. So each organization has different regulations based on their umbrella. My organization is not required to report these diversity statistics to the nationals branch. They only regulate more so in terms of what the new member education process is like, how many members there are, what the dues amount is. That's kind of what it is. They do have some regulation, but we're not required to report statistics. So sorry, can you remind me of the other part of your question?
Yeah, it would just be like, why, what are the, you know, are there any big reasons why that they wouldn't?
Yeah, I can quickly list out kind of the reasons why they would want to be in PFC and the reasons why they wouldn't. The biggest reason why they wouldn't is primarily because we do ask some information, like request information from them. So we request that they provide us a full DE&I report of the people that rush their organization, as well as the people that are accepted into the organization and the demographics of their current brotherhood. So apart from that, we also ask for them to publish their dues amount, things like that. It's kind of mostly—
That's your time.
Oh, sorry.
Thank you, I'm so sorry. So I actually have a question for you before we go into our last question. Mm-hmm. So I was just wondering, please correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe that this was already a stipulation within your constitution, was reporting basically these statistics. I was wondering if you've had any concerns from any PFOs that have kind of mentioned this in the past, especially if it's already a current policy.
Yeah, so we have the information from, last semester, we actually had a little bit more trouble collecting demographic data, but two semesters ago, we had a decent amount of organizations actually report their diversity statistics. I can quickly run through those if that helps. So the general members of professional organizations tend to skew a little more female than male, but I wouldn't necessarily say that this is something, because we do have ROSAI ADA, which is a completely female comprised organization. So apart from that, I think there tends to be less people than average that have financial aid. And also the two biggest groups that we have are Caucasian people and also Asians in these organizations. Apart from that, we haven't noticed any other really huge glaring issues, and we compared these to Cornell's diversity statistics that they report.
Thank you so much. Last question. Anyone else? That's the second speaker's list. Okay, Representative Katie.
I don't think I clarified this previously on my first question. I'm asking, have specific organizations refused to give this information? And then a follow-up to that, have these organizations then involved some sort of threat or suggestion of leaving because of that?
Yeah, it has happened before. So
currently?
Currently? Not in the current semester, no. The deadline hasn't passed for them to give us their diversity information yet, if that is what you're asking. But in the past, we've had resolutions being brought up to the e-board of PFC. So I know one of these involved, you know, some organizations being regulated and being forced to have recruitment held on a certain weekend and having things like that. And the organization that was
trying or that didn't want to be regulated, threatened that they would leave PFC if anything like that was being forced upon them. So we haven't had that issue in terms of funding, to the best of my knowledge. I started my term last semester, but I think it is kind of a general thing from, so the e-board of PFC is comprised of people in different organizations, and their e-boards have spoken about how they would leave PFC if it became too stringent.
Perfect. Thank you so much, Jennifer. That's our time for questions, but I'll give you a second if you wanted to say anything to finish up. If not,
I think I'm okay. Yeah, I just really want to reiterate that I care a lot about this organization, and we do care a lot about diversity, equity, and inclusion. And we don't want to, like, we are not trying to cover for any organizations that have issues with the diversity statistics of their brotherhood. It's just that we really want this organization to keep going in the future. And I think that the initiatives that we have are like doing good, and we're pushing people towards the right direction. But funding is definitely one of the biggest reasons why people stay with PFC. And that's why we would like to have it in the future.
Perfect. Thank you so much.
Can I make a motion to amend?
Yes.
I'd like to motion to amend the agenda so that there's, you know, we can have an election update from the Director of Elections, the permit immediately.
Do we have a second to that? Okay, I need a second to that. Perfect.
I have on this list from the Secretary of State 250 names. No? No one doesn't have a joke. Oh, well. I have your election
Patrick,
results.
We can't hear you. Sorry.
Can you hear me now?
Yes.
I have your election results. There are no challenges as of today. So as of 4 p.m., all candidates have either submitted their petition form or their apologies, their financial forms. If they haven't, I'm sorry, we will not be reimbursing you. First thing to share with the transfer elections, we had a 0.02% increase in voter turnout. There was 300 less transfers this year than last year. On the freshman side, we had a 31.13% increase in voter turnout, and that is including 700 more freshmen in the voting pool. The raw number without including the new freshman pool is almost a 50% increase in votes cast. So your freshman representatives, in no particular order, are Michelle Song, Luna Liu, Andrew Juan, and Pedro de Silveria, your freshman representatives. And your transfer representative is Joanne Kim. Those are your five new members. They're gonna be here next week for their swearing in. And I encourage all of you to show them the same respect and love that you all show each other. If you want the exact numbers, 1,112 freshmen voted, 162 transfers voted. All of the information as of 2 seconds ago is now publicly posted on the website if you wish with all the exact data, and that's everything. Thank you all so much.
Congratulations to our new members of the Student Assembly. We're very excited to work with you soon. Now I will move to our next thing on the agenda, which is an announcement from Representative Baker.
Thank you. I invite you all to open up your Cornell box and look at the byline reports in there, because that's what I'll be referring to.
Actually, before you speak, can we have an extension on time? We have 5 minutes left.
I motion to extend time by 10 minutes. We have 15 minutes.
We have 10. Do we have a second? Second, okay. We are now going to 6:40. And then everyone can pull out their laptops.
First of all, for the actual announcement, I'm required to do this by the SA Charter, but our next byline hearings this Monday from 5:15 to 8:30 p.m. in 145 McGraw Hall. So that is where that is. And I do not have the organization's names yet because they haven't submitted their final application yet, but I'll know by tomorrow. Okay, so. Look at the eco one first. Okay, so we can't actually vote on these today because of the charter, so we can vote on them next week, but I'm just presenting them. And these aren't actual resolutions, they're just reports. Okay, so for ECO, their request was 81 cents. The committee decided to allocate 75 cents. ECO has been made aware of this. They accepted the 75 cents and they will not be appealing. So the reasoning is because, first of all, they found ways to cut costs for all of their regular programming and events, which we commend them for. Second, they are expecting a reimbursement of $2,000. So with their request of 81 cents, they would have, like, based on what they have said their predicted spending looks like, they would have had like an excess $2,000 over that, over those 2 years. So then we decided that we only needed to give them an allocation of about 11,000 for the 2 years. So that was why we decided to decrease from what they requested by $900. And the committee also noted that since SAFC now funds for food, then since ECO's, well, half of their budget goes to co-sponsorships, and then like I think 80% of that goes to food. So since SAFC now funds food, it's reasonable to conclude that they won't need to be funding as much their co-sponsorships. So then the committee is hoping that they'll find more creative ways to use their funding in the future, and also will develop new regular events like EcoFest and the Golden Gorges and events like that that have high student impact and low cost per student. So yes, they're not appealing. So that's ECO. Any questions? Okay, I'll do the student assembly now. Since I'm the SA treasurer, Annie had to chair during this part, so because of a conflict of interest, because I presented, so she'll do this one.
Hi, with the permission of Annalie and Morgan, I chaired this meeting, this deliberation. So the student assembly's allocation during this current byline cycle was $4. They requested $150 for the upcoming cycle, and that is what the appropriations committee recommended. It is primarily due to the massive amount left in the reserve account of the student assembly right now. The committee was very happy that the SA has a detailed plan to lower that reserve account balance of over $90,000 to $20,000 to keep there. Also, the committee recommended the work of the SA to dramatically increase the summer experience grant, which allows students to pursue enriching summer opportunities that they might not have been able to afford previously. And if there's any other questions about the committee's decision on the student assembly, I can also take that.
Okay, motion to adjourn the meeting. Oh, I'm so sorry. Okay, per Lucas Smith's request, he wants to motion to amend to add Annie and I as co-sponsors of the resolution to dissolve SILO so that we can get that done today. Look favorably upon a second.
Do we have any dissent to that? Point of order.
We can't vote on the reports today. That's next week. So I motion to amend the agenda first to add SILO, and then I'll motion to amend to add Annie Nye's co-sponsors.
Okay. So do we have a second to amend the agenda? Second. Okay, perfect. So now we're opening to co-sponsors. And we had a second to that?
Second.
Perfect. Are we trying to vote on that? Are you presenting?
Okay, yeah. You all know it's just to dissolve the City and Local Affairs Committee because the Office of Student Government Relations has taken over their job. And so there is no more need for it. Okay, I will now open to discussion.
Any questions or comments? Representative Templeman.
Second.
Perfect. Do we have any dissent to that? Amazing. Congratulations. Your resolution passes.
Motion to adjourn the meeting.
Second, do we have a dissent? I know you have a dissent.
I was going to dissent about the UA committee appointment. I think it will take 2 seconds if we're comfortable with doing it, but if not, I'm not.
Is this? Yeah, it was on the agenda. So we're actually on that. Okay, what is the appointment
you'd like to make? I'd like to appoint Patrick Mailer. He, I think, just left, but he asked me to appoint him to campus planning committee. I also have in writing his acceptance of that nomination. So I believe we just need then a second for that.
I actually, for a second, and maybe I'll defer to Wendy. Was the campus planning the one that we had the issues with?
So he's a community member, not an entity representative.
Yes, but regardless, I think we actually might have.
In that case, can we table for next week? So I was going to nominate Patrick to the campus planning committee. Representative Templeman brought up a point that there might be the conflict of the 2-year serving limits with this nomination. So we're just asking for clarity on that, if you know the answer to it. In that case, I motion to table.
Yep, let's motion to table, and then I'll have that for us by next week. We have a second to motion to table. Second, okay. Yes. Do we have a second? Okay, perfect. Thank you.
This has been a production of Cornell University. On the web at cornell.edu.